again, just because these readings are so rich, I would just like to make a little comment before I get to what I wanted to talk about. This thing from Jeremiah is really important. Jeremiah is called the first individualist in the Bible. Jeremiah, if you read the book of Jeremiah, you could almost write a psychological biography of him. He's about the only person in the entire Bible about whom that's true. He's an extraordinary man. And he's the one who also been called the prophet of the heart. So he has that wonderful line, "I'll take away their hearts of stone and give them hearts of flesh," or "I'll write my law on the heart." But what I want to point out particularly is this is this thing that he is saying in the name of God, that God's promising that people are not going to have to teach each other, but everybody will be taught by God. And he's not talking about heaven, because at this time people didn't believe in heaven. They figured, once you're dead, you're dead. Jeremiah was talking about the real possibility for us human beings living in such a way that there were no kind of intellectual or academic poobahs who were going to lay down the law for everybody else, because the Spirit of God would be operating in people and everybody would know. What I'm getting at is, this would be a good lesson for the bishops to learn, I think, and church leaders to learn, about the nature of leadership in the church. You know, we still suffer from the Reaganesque notion of the trickle-down view of authority, with one boss on top and it kind of dribbles down to the peons on the bottom. No, unfortunately the way it is. It's not the way it's supposed to be. About Jesus learning obedience, this word obedience is kind of beat up in the Bible. What does Jesus obey? He obeyed his own humanity, first of all. He lived his life in this way and said, well, this is the price of the ride. That lovely phrase of Jane Baldwin. This is what it costs to be a human being, to be faithful, to be obedient to that in the face of opposition from the world. And that's what I want to talk about. Finally, this little passage from John. John's gospel is weird in all manner of ways, but John's gospel does not have an agony in the garden, if you recall. On Good Friday, the passion narrative from John is read, and Jesus is just standing there totally in charge of everything. So Jesus is there, standing upright, said, "Who are you guys looking for?" And he said, "Jesus of Nazareth," said, "I am he," and then they all fall down. You don't have this sweat pouring down like blood and all this other kind of stuff, which is John's particular take on Jesus. I bring that up only because there's a little echo of an agony in the garden in this. I am troubled now. And that's as close as the Joe 9 Jesus gets. And the glorification that Jesus talks about in the whole second half of the Gospel of John has been called the Book of Glory. What's God glorified by? God's glorified by human beings living out the full scope of their humanity. Again, this kind of obedience to living integrally and living with integrity in the world. All right, so good readings if you're looking for something to pray over during the week. But now we're about the end, because next Sunday is Palm Sunday. But at the end of this wilderness business, I'd like to make the final suggestion about this constituting a wilderness. Because that's where we're supposed to live as Christians. There is one human experience, maybe more, but one eminent human experience which is itself that of the wilderness, without any kind of religious reference at all. Wilderness, again, being the sense of dislocated, unknown, lost. And that is the experience, I suggest, of suffering. And suffering comes to everybody in one way or another. I suffer because my putt's off. I suffer because the stock market is going belly up. I suffer because my RSPs are worth nothing or virtually nothing. I suffer because my husband's an alcoholic, because I'm addicted to power or sex or booze. Everybody suffers from something. Everybody suffers from something. No matter how you slice human life, everybody suffers from something. And there's an interesting affect of suffering. There's a wonderful line in a little opera by Samuel Barber where a woman is talking about her mother who's dying, cocooned in pain. Cocooned in pain. The line was penned by Barber's partner, homosexual partner, Giancarlo Menotti. But that's a wonderful, wonderful line, I think. I've always been trying. Cocooned in pain. Because what happens when you're in pain? The rest of the world doesn't want to be near you and keep sending that message to you all the time. This is a downer. This is, we're into negative territory here. We're interested in negativity. No, we're not interested in negativity. Negativity is bad. You got to think positive. Accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. That's a very bad old song used to put it in the 40s. And because, especially we in America who live in this analgesic society where there is a solution to every form of suffering, Viagra, Prozac, Valium, morphine. And I'm not against any of those things, obviously. But we've constituted an entire society of solutions to pain of whatever kind. So, as one great aspirin ad had it, pain is unfair. In the normal North American view of human life, pain, I think, is clearly experienced and understood as being unfair. This ought not to be happening to me. And so, the standard response to pain is, why me? Why me? And everybody else, of course, averts their eyes. Partly, I think, as a footnote, because we all know we're all liable to that same experience. And it's dreadful concomitant. Pain is, therefore, essentially a wilderness experience. Suffering puts us out of the mainstream. Suffering singularizes us. Suffering creates a cocoon, breaking all the ties of communication. One kind of odd instance of this is that famous line from Bill Clinton that became kind of a joke. I feel your pain. We all knew that that's impossible. That's impossible. That may have been a good political strategy, but we all know, at bottom, that's impossible. Not only don't I feel your pain, but I don't even want to feel your pain. And that's the subtext of that feeling your pain. Okay, so we have already this sort of natural substrate for a religious understanding of wilderness. Then we have to make the next step, which is to ask that terrifying question, what makes me suffer? Why do I suffer? Because just as suffering is as variable as anything in the world, so the reasons for underlying suffering, causative of suffering, are variable too. To be Christian is to address that question in a specific way. To give a unique answer to that question of what makes me suffer. Pain is a great isolating experience. So I can go through everything that I've tried to say something sensible about for the last month and find in there an occasion for suffering that is authentically Christian. Silence in a world full of noise. Not only is silence difficult, but silence is painful, too. Silence seems to say solitude, hopelessness, emptiness. Rather than, as Christians we'd like to say, it creates an aperture to hear the still small voice of God, which is usually occluded by the noise with which we surround ourselves, immerse ourselves. The question of pace and a kind of keeping up mentality that dynamizes the pace of our life. Keeping up with what? With what the world expects of us. You must be productive. You must be efficient. You must be self-fulfilled. And we're all literally hell-bent, driven by that agenda, which is not the agenda of the gospel. I mean, unless the grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a grain of wheat. To say no to that self-imposed pace, that drivenness, is suffering, and peculiarly Christian suffering. Poverty, as I tried to say last week, is very difficult. Even if you take that little suggestion that I made, that in the back of your head you plant this little black, handicapped, poor, female, homosexual human being who just accompanies you, who gives you a new lens through which to see the world. That's not easy to do. Why? Because inevitably it's going to make us feel uncomfortable. It's going to make us suffer. So we have, in the experience of suffering, the makings of a wilderness that is truly a wilderness in which we can set ourselves free to look for God. The suffering that is attendant on every human life can be sorted out. Point one. Point two, even the suffering that we endure can be interpreted in a drastically different way. Namely, as if it's kind of some unjust assault on my being. But rather, the sole road to truth and goodness and myself and God. There's a line from the old musical that has always struck me as a very profound and authentic Christian meaning. Without a hurt, the heart is hollow. Without a hurt, the heart is hollow. And everybody knows that. Every time I go into class, here are all these lovely, beautiful, unlined faces. And they're online because they're young. But then, in the class I have right now, there's a girl who had a stroke, a paralyzing stroke, her last year in high school. She's still disabled to some extent. She can move a little bit. It's amazing. I'm having a little interviews with the 27 people in that class. And so she and I met. Not once in 20 minutes did she look me squarely in the face. It's an extraordinary experience. Why? Because her physical condition has simply put her out of the running, literally, in every sense. Cocooned in pain. And then there's a black girl who writes her weekly essays on the experience of being black in Canada and female. To break open our hearts so that we can accommodate these people and reread our own pain in a way that sees it not as something violating us, but something enabling us. That, I think, may be the greatest gift that the wilderness can offer us.